Welcome to this episode of an unnamed podcast, as we occasionally release interviews with guests to campus at the Free Lutheran Bible College and Seminary. I'm Wade Mobley. I serve as president of the Bible College and Seminary, and I am here with Philip Dearborn, the president of the Association for Biblical Higher Education. Philip, how are you doing today?
I am doing fantastic. Such a pleasure to be here. I actually like the title of that. That's maybe the title of the podcast, the unnamed podcast.
And you have a podcast.
I do. Biblical Higher Ed Talk. Check us out.
On all of your favorite podcast platforms, I do listen regularly, but not weekly. And every time I listen, I'm glad I did.
Very good. And we're on YouTube now, too.
So. Oh, it's a video.
We are.
Okay, so we try to keep all of our... We try to stay off camera when I'm involved.
For obvious reasons.
For obvious reasons, that's right. So, well, I'm so glad to have you on campus. We had our 60th anniversary celebration dinner last night.
Was it a gala? Or
it was. I conceived of it as a gala, and I wrote it down G-A-L-A, and then later found out that there are three pronunciations. And we've haggled about this, and last night I just didn't use the word at all.
You did a fine job.
Well, thank you. And you did a fine job. This is now a mutual admiration society that we're in together. You did a fine job presenting last night. I'm just glad I was able to find a spot in your calendar.
Absolutely. So it's kind of a funny story because you had reached out 788 days prior to last evening to see if I was perhaps available for this evening. So I did do some checking with my people to make sure it worked, but my calendar was clear.
I probably overestimated the demand for your speaking services at that time. You were newer to the role, so I wanted to get that locked in for our 60th, and I planned backwards. You had Don Sweeting here one year.
Okay.
And my friend Ron Hunter, D6 Family Ministries and Randall House Publishing, and the president of the AFLC spoke too.
Wow.
And nobody knows who any of these other people are, but they knew who that was.
Yeah,
so they showed up in droves.
I thought it was job security that you were just booking me so far in advance, knowing that you would still be president 2 years later.
That might have been optimistic at times. So it is really good to have you here. Dr. Dearborn is a friend of the Free Lutheran Bible College and Seminary, my friend, and a friend of Christian higher education. Tell us, I'm going to reverse your question back to you. A transformative experience, a time in your life where you saw Jesus giving you direction to where you've been today.
Yeah, like so many Christ followers, there are just so many that you can reflect back. And I see a lot of points in my life that God used circumstances. One of my favorite verses is Proverbs 16:9, in his heart a man plans his course, but the Lord determines his steps. And there's just so many instances where God used circumstances to direct each one of those steps. Being raised in a Christian home, my parents were missionaries. I was actually born in France and spent 7 years there, and then moved to the Philadelphia area, which is kind of where I feel like I grew up. And so church kid, every time the doors were open, the Dearborn family was in church. And so I think I took a lot for granted. And in that process of making faith my own, in my 11th grade year of high school, I had a very bizarre inner ear infection that pretty much just wiped me out and my sense of balance. So I literally spent a couple months of that year in bed.
Wow.
Because of it. And it was my local pastor, Rich McCarroll, from Grace Chapel, would come and visit me, in our home. And I just remember conversations with him, where he was just kind of asking some of the hard questions of, so what are you going to do in life? And, you know, this, you're a Christ follower, but what does that mean? What about ministry? How's God created you? So really ask some of those, hard questions that as a teenager, no one had asked me before. And God really used that to set a trajectory. And I see that as one of those catalytic moments that set a trajectory for me to understand who I was, what it means to be created in the image of God, and recognition of what my gifts and talents and abilities are, and how can I use those for his service. So that was really that one catalytic moment for me.
You are one of the rare people in our movement who I don't think you ever served as a pastor full time, right?
I did not.
Many of us are like well-intentioned pastors who are trying to transition to higher education.
Yeah.
And there's a learning curve there, but that's fascinating too. So you're about my age, which means very young, but you have three grown children and a grandchild.
We do.
Tell me about your family a little bit.
We do. So my wife, Amy, and I have three children, adult children, 25, 23, 21, our son-in-law, Kyle, and Kyle and Michaela gave us Haven, which we are just having the time of our lives, 10 months old. And my middle son, Ryan, is a student at St. Joe's University as a nursing student. And then our son, Jack, is at home, and he's at Millersville University studying business administration. So
Millersville, is that in Ephrata?
No,
is that?
That's in Millersville.
Oh, sorry. what a great name for it.
Yeah.
Is it near Lancaster?
Yes, it is. It's in Lancaster County. Yes.
I got a buddy who lives in Ephrata who went there. Now I'm figuring out what it was.
Yeah.
So I remember they have a bad football team this year, and he's been talking about that.
I would say Ephrata is probably about 30, 40 minutes away from
I was just out there visiting some other colleges and some of our churches and supporters and the Muhlenberg Church, Henry Melchior Muhlenberg, mm-hmm. First Lutheran and Lutheran churches in America. So loads of fun. Lots of history where you live.
Lots of history.
We're fairly new around here. So 1800s. But okay, so Association for Biblical Higher Education. I know where you are now, and I want to get back to that. Mm-hmm. But prior to this, provost at Lancaster.
Bible College, gotcha. 26 years.
And that's where, what was before that?
There was nothing before that. So it was 26 years, started in the admissions office recruiting students and worked all the way up to provost. And about 5 years ago now, just kind of sensed God's call that there was something, there was kind of that unrest. And it was answering the call to become president of the Association for Biblical Higher Education.
And I'm trying to remember the president, who I think is fantastic, former president. Before Tommy.
Ralph. Peter Tegg.
Peter Tegg.
Yeah.
Great guy. So you got to work with Peter.
Yeah. Peter and I served together 21 years of that 26, and gem of a guy. Taught me a lot about leadership.
And then your predecessor at ABHE, Ralph Enloe, great man as well.
Yes.
So that's good. Okay, so to whoever's listening to this, there's a good chance they don't really know much about accreditation or what that is. And I know it's not, accreditation is just a part of what you do. Tell us about the Association for Biblical Higher Education.
Yeah, so we've been around since 1947, and we were actually one of the first accreditors recognized by the U.S. Department of Education when that kind of came onto the scene. So the way we describe it, so biblical higher education is a movement that started, within the context of the local church 120 years ago, where churches were looking around and realizing that, the colleges and universities of the day were not actually preparing leaders and lay leaders for the church. And so in the context of the church, they started little Bible institutes, oftentimes in back of church auditoriums or church basements. And that was kind of the genesis. So schools like Moody Bible Institute or NIAC at the time, BIOLA, mm-hmm. Bible Institute of Los Angeles.
Yep.
So all of these Bible institutes started up. And then in 1947, a number of them got together and decided, hey, from a quality assurance. So when you talk about accreditation, the key term is quality assurance. How do we make sure that we are keeping the promises that we make? How do we make sure that institutions are keeping the promises that they make to their students? And so that's the birth of it. But ABHE is a movement. We have 162 colleges and universities throughout North America, 19 in Canada, 2 in Alaska, 1 in Hawaii, 2 in Puerto Rico, and the rest are in the continental United States. But together, they enroll over 72,000 students. And
that's an amazing number.
Yeah.
Okay, if you think about that, there's 72,000 future families, congregations, mm-hmm. communities.
Yeah.
It's an amazing impact.
Yeah, it truly is. And if you do the math, it's a lot of smaller schools that we service. And the term that's kind of emerging, which is kind of a fascinating one that describes Bible colleges or Bible institutes, is that they're boutique institutions, which has a more positive take than small single purpose institutions, which is what the way we're often labeled. But if you take the concept of the, you know, our institutions are not Walmart. They don't have 60 majors. They don't have 90 majors, 30 majors. They offer a very specific experience for students, and they're not for everybody. Just like on Main Street, there are boutique stores that cater to certain, they only sell certain things. And that's our institutions. And a lot of our institutions are about training men and women for ministry contexts. We offer leadership training. We're launching into the biggest group on our campus, other than students, are faculty, 6,000 faculty members at all of our institutions. And so we're launching some training experiences for faculty about how they can teach effectively in the classroom, as well as biblical integration content. So those are the services we provide. And then one of the big services we provide then is accreditation, mm-hmm. recognized by the U.S. Department of Education, as well as a group called CHEA, not CHEA PET,
yeah,
but CHEA.
CHEA.
Yeah, Council for, I'm sorry, Commission for Higher Education Authorization. So the big thing is it's where accreditation provides access to Title IV funding, which is student financial aid. So in order for an institution to accept aid, they have to be accredited by a U.S. Department of Education recognized accreditor.
Okay, so when people hear accreditation, sometimes they think, oh, what are they making us do
now?
You got
it. Yep.
And people blame accreditors, and I really don't. My experience with TRACS and ABHE has been wholly positive.
Yes.
And always beneficial. So I don't buy it at all. But let's just play that game for a second.
Yeah.
If ABHE made colleges and universities and seminaries do some things, what would you make those things do?
You know, it's an interesting question. There are elements that we actually do make our students mm-hmm. or our institutions do, and that's captured in our standards. But those are functional standards, mm-hmm. right? So. And so if we had a magic wand and required, it would be, you know, fully focused on the Word of God through all of the curriculum. And that's actually captured in our,
standards. So the Bible's in there.
Yes. Okay? Yes. Yes.
And I guess the other part of it broadly, I'm fishing, I guess.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
You make us do what we say we're doing.
Exactly. So that's probably the biggest misconception. So accreditation at its core is a peer review process that other colleges look at other colleges and through that peer review process, make determinations about issues of quality. And at the core of accreditation is the idea of, we're not going to tell you what to do. We have standards, we have expectations. Those are functional kinds of things. But really what we're doing is saying, what's your mission and what evidence do you have that says that you're actually fulfilling your mission? So if we were telling somebody what to do, we'd tell them what their mission had to be.
Yes.
And I would say even for secular accreditors, what we're formerly known as regional accreditors, mm-hmm. we won't get into that detail. Even the secular ones like Middle States and Higher Learning Commission start with the premise of, what is your mission and what evidence do you have to demonstrate that you are actually meeting that mission? And that truly is the core of accreditation.
That's a great benefit. And to me, you could also, with a strong executive or a strong board, you could hold yourself accountable to those things.
Yep.
But sometimes it takes an outside view. You become blind to your own blindness. So having somebody outside asking those questions is very, very helpful.
It is. And no institution has ever reached the mark of perfection of how they function. So we can all do better, and blind spots are blind to us. So a lot of times you need that outside perspective of somebody to reveal what some of those blind spots are. And that's the accreditation process there's usually a self-study that's written and a visiting team made up of peers from other institutions that come in and provide that evaluative functionality. But there has been recent pressure because accreditors are recognized by the U.S. Department of Education. So as legislation is passed in Washington, D.C. for any number of different things for accreditors, then that gets passed along then to institutions. So I would say the Department of Education has engaged more than they did perhaps 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Without going down some you know, political rabbit trails that you and I may talk about privately. I'm going to end with challenges and opportunities, but I just want to reflect a little bit about what I see with ABHE.
Yeah.
And what we've benefited from. We've also benefited from tracks in similar ways, okay, but with, particularly through ABHE, board governance training, how to maximally leverage and use the board that God has given us to govern. That's been great. Out of that, strategic planning training to look at a 3-year rolling strategic plan so you're never looking at it on a shelf gathering dust.
Right.
Donor relations help. Or me being a I went through that executive leadership training that was so helpful because I'm a pastor. I'm a recovering basketball coach and engineer. And there are actually skills to being an administrator. And so all kinds of learning that we've received. I think probably the biggest thing we've received from ABHE is that we know we're not alone.
Yeah.
Sometimes you feel like you're just on an island.
Yep.
And the perspective of it, small, you know, we're small compared to a big college or, you know, if it's Liberty or the University of Minnesota, we're small. But when I saw the enrollment data a year ago that we were number 29 of 155 among ABHE schools in incoming fall class, and we have one program, all residential, all full-time, I realized, wait a second, we're not small, we're focused, we're narrow.
Exactly.
And that perspective, it does no good to sit around talking about how small you are.
Yeah.
And so that perspective is, wait a second, no, we have unique challenges and opportunities, get to work.
Yeah, yeah. And you've put a finger on something that I've observed. So I've been in higher education in the industry for 3 decades, which means I'm in my 4th decade, right? Which makes me feel very old when I talk about it.
It makes you 52 or 61.
Somewhere in that range. Yeah. Lower end of that range.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I've observed is an identity crisis among smaller colleges and even universities. Like, we're never satisfied with where we're at, and we're becoming something else. And I think there's pressure, and there's probably some historical evidence to it too, that says, well, the evolution of a small college is to become a university. And so we have to be on this trajectory of having 1,000 students with 60 majors. But in the process, we abandon the present. And what I encourage people to do is step into their identity, know who you are, and don't be dissatisfied with that. Actually lean into it and be comfortable with who you are as an institution. And that's your mission, and zero in on that mission. And that may mean that your institution is 150 students or 200 students. Our smallest school, St. Photius, has 12 students, and they live in community in Northern California. Our largest institution is Southeastern University with 10,800 students. So we have the full range, but to me, size is another issue.
Yep.
I like to think in terms of, what's your identity, and have you stepped into it? Do you own who? Are you proud of who you are, or are you on this race, this treadmill, this wheel of trying to become something that you're not? And there's this continual dissatisfaction with who you are.
It's really unholy. At some point, it's thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's mission.
It's so true. And if you're in this industry of higher education, you walk into a professional conference and it just drips with it. Mm-hmm. It's comparing, well, you know, what's your enrollment this year? And trying to position yourself in these contexts. And it's just like, why do we do that? Why can't we just be happy with who we are?
Amen. And so it's possible for institutions to be insecure, just like it's possible for individuals.
Here's
to
the
be
deal.
Insecure.
Institutions are made up of people. People are insecure. People have sin natures, and they simply reflect that.
Yeah, there it is. There it is. So, okay, here's where I want to end.
Yep.
Challenges and opportunities in Christian higher education, they tend to go together.
Yep.
And I'll just let you comment on that for a while, and we'll get you on the road.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I have to put a disclaimer whenever I talk about challenges and opportunities is that I'm an eternal optimist. Mm-hmm. The glass is always half full. So I see opportunity all over the place. So I confess that bias. There's no question the industry of higher education is full of challenges. I think it's top heavy. I'm not sure, and I'm speaking in the most general terms of all of higher education, community colleges, state colleges, universities, Christian colleges, Bible colleges. The model, I think, is perhaps broken, and it's not sustainable. We're seeing colleges and universities across the board closing all the time because they, and the crazy thing is they're closing with students enrolled with full classrooms, and they've just bought into this discount rate where they over discount their product, and they can't afford to pay the faculty and staff on their campuses. So the system itself, I think, is a challenge. In that is an opportunity, and I think you're hitting that opportunity where we don't have to be Walmart. We don't have to provide all of these degree programs. There are other schools out there. But what's the unique value that we can provide to the market? And I think you're stepping into that space. No question, challenge. There's increased regulation that's coming out of Washington, D.C., that's coming out of our states, our local communities. And that's having an impact on our institutions being able to hire people just to produce reports to the Department of Education. And I think that becomes a challenge. I think the opportunity there is to step into that. And I'm part of a group called NICU, the National Association of Independent Colleges and Universities. I'm on the board. And so we have conversations about this. And we have opportunity. The beauty of the Republic, Democratic Republic that we live in, is that we have access to Washington, D.C. And I can go in and I can talk to senators. I can talk to the House of Representatives about the issues that matter to biblical higher education. That's the beauty of it. So I think the opportunity there is for those who pass those laws and regulations that we can actually speak into it and say, hey, in the process of this, keep in mind X, Y, and Z about our industry. The enrollment cliff is a challenge. There's data out there that says people aren't having babies like they once did.
Since 08.
You got it. So, but the opportunity is in there is if you actually look at the numbers, there's one sector that is actually growing significantly, that's right. And that's the Hispanic community. And that's the fastest growing ethnicity in the country for evangelical churches, as well as college age students. So the opportunity is, okay, how are we reaching that demographic with programming? So I'd say those are some of the top ones.
There's a handful of ABHE schools that are first language Spanish, right?
Oh, absolutely. No question about it. And it's premature for me to talk about it, but we're looking at a partnership with an organization that represents Hispanic Bible institutes and colleges and helping them go through the accreditation process and them helping our institutions put in Hispanic programming that reaches Hispanic students. So again, that's that opportunity. But I live my life that way. Whenever I see a challenge, I'm always looking for, okay, so what's the opportunity? It's a disposition. And I think if our colleges respond that way, I think it's not living vicariously or too optimistic, but it's saying, okay, yes, this is a challenge, but we're able to realize this in that process.
Okay, so I said that was where we're going to end. I guess I wanted, this is too much of an opportunity. Without puffery, familiarity breeds contempt.
Yeah.
For many of the people in our circle, we are the only institution of higher education they know, mm-hmm. particularly from the Christian mm-hmm. private arena. A third party observation as you step onto campus, what would you want our constituency to know about this place?
Yeah, so it's been I've been here last night and then today and just so incredibly encouraged by what I see, and I would say I have a higher sense of emotional intelligence in being able to walk into rooms and see what's happening and engage. And last night at our table, we had three beautiful students. Man, they just looked you in the eye and they engaged with you and they had conversation. And and the team that you have, the faculty, the staff members, are just aligned with the mission. And you can definitely sense that just stepping on campus. Beautiful facilities, small, but absolutely beautiful, well-maintained. But again, the size of it doesn't matter. It's the fact that the facilities are meeting the needs of the
facilitating the mission.
You got it. Yep. You got it. You got it. And there's an energy. There's a positivity that's here. And whenever I've done this, I think I've been on 65 or 70 campuses, and you know right away. Mm-hmm. As soon as you walk on campus, you can kind of sense where the tensions are, and there's a lightness here. There's a freshness. There's a clear mission, and I'm sure you have issues that you have to work through. But we have
opportunities.
You have opportunities. Exactly right.
Oh, that's good. Well, it's always good having a friend on campus and introducing friends from different spheres of influence, I think, is one of the funnest things in the job.
Yeah.
So that's a banquet last night. I got to look out and see everybody. And yes. I knew almost everybody there just because of, you know, the job.
Yeah.
But it's so fun to get those people in the room together.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Thanks for being part of that.
It was a beautiful night, a great way to celebrate 60 years of God's faithfulness. Y'all are stewards. That's a big thing that I talk about. And you are stewarding the mission of this place incredibly well. So keep it up.
Thank you. And thank you to our guest, Dr. Philip Dearborn, president of the Association for Biblical Higher Education. Also, producer Luke Quambeck. We will get this up along with a link in the show notes to the banquet last night, the program that we had. So thank you for joining us for this time. And we will see you again next time when we have an interview with a friend on campus.